Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
You and I must make a plan. So I'm welcoming fellow American Monica Wood.
Yay.
To London, to Radio Gorgeous. And I'm hoping that London and the UK and the world welcomes you and your book.
Well, so far, so good.
Yes. The One in a Million Boy.
Yes.
Which is your fourth book.
It's my fifth novel. It's my fourth novel, but my fifth book.
Yes.
Right,
exactly. Because you had a memoir.
Yes.
And I think we are going to touch on that a little bit.
Okay.
Just let you know, because I just had a glimmer of an idea.
Okay.
Because I don't want to give away anything that you wouldn't want me to give away and you wouldn't want readers to know before they read it.
Okay.
But introduce the story to us.
I will.
In that vein.
Okay. The novel revolves around a friendship between a 104-year-old Lithuanian immigrant woman named Ona Vitkus and a sweet, strange 11-year-old Boy Scout who is doing her chores every Saturday as a community service to earn a merit badge. He is obsessed with the Guinness Book of Records and, in fact, has talked her into going for the record of oldest licensed driver because she's far too young to go. At 104, she's too young to go for oldest living person, which is a surprise to them when they figure that out. So she's going for oldest licensed driver, but first she has to get her license back because it was taken away by her doctor back when she was 100. Now, on page 2 of this novel, you discover that this little boy has recently died of a 1-in-a-million heart ailment. And in his place, on a Saturday, Quinn Porter comes to Ona's door. Quinn is a 42-year-old guitar player, professional guitar player, and he is the boy's father, who has been guilted into coming here by his twice ex-wife, Belle, the boy's mother, as a kind of a penance for his fatherly failures, and he is here to fulfill his son's requirements for this merit badge. He's there reluctantly, and what happens is another friendship forms between Quinn and this woman, and that's what gives the novel its plot line. But even though the boy is gone at the beginning of the book, he is very present in the book. In fact, some readers have told me they forgot he was dead. He's very alive in the book. We see him in several ways through flashback, through these lists that he makes that are world records, but he inserts his own little things into these lists. And also, he's been recording Ona's life story for a fifth grade oral history project. And through those recordings, you discover the depth of the friendship between this woman and this little boy, because Ona confides in this child things she has not confided in a living soul her whole 104-year-old life. So there's a lot of story. It's both woven and layered. There's a lot of different stories in it. There's a Christian rock band that Quinn is kind of a father figure to. There's a little road trip. There's just a lot going on in the book, but that's the basics that you would want to know before you enter the journey.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's remarkable about the book, as you say, this lovely little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear my voice.
Oh, my God, you're crying!
I saw it my way through. Oh, my goodness. Dripping all the while. Because he is evoked so beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
And authentically. And I love it that you have to comfort me.
Oh,
but
I wish your listeners could see this. She's got tears running down her face, and I'm holding onto her arm.
Aww. But he's absolutely pivotal to the plot, but he is nameless.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that allowed, as you can hear, mm-hmm, and tell, that allows the reader to create him for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It allows us even more. Even if he had a name, he wouldn't be mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it really allowed it really invites the reader to create this person that, as you say, for other readers, you don't think of him as having passed away. Was that purposeful?
You know, it was funny. It was a while into... This book took forever to write.
Why?
It's a whole long story. Let me answer the first one first, and then I'll tell you the sad story of this book's journey to publication. But I wrote it for a while, realizing that I had never named this child. And the more I thought about, okay, what the heck is this kid's name going to be? I didn't want to pin him. He's ethereal in a way that I love. And I felt that naming him it was like a butterfly, that if you name him, you pin him to the velvet board, you know? And so I decided in the end that he should be nameless, that he's referred to just as the boy. And when people who obviously know his name in the book, I very cleverly just work the dialogue so the name just never happens to come up. And it just felt right for him because he's more of a presence than a character. And he does have a name, by the way, and only I and my husband and my older sister know it. My sister named him, actually. And that was back when I thought, you know, I think this is just too weird. I'm going to have to give the kid a name. And in the end, I didn't. So I love... Some people, it takes a while before they realize he doesn't have a name. And I think they like that.
Well, and I think you think... It sort of seamlessly happens that you think it's going to happen. You're like, oh, well, it'll come up. And the fact that it hasn't is like, well, yeah, and I didn't need it to.
Yes, yeah.
You realize that it's not necessary. It's also helpful because it doesn't... He has quirks, mm-hmm. shall we say.
Yeah.
That are frequently labeled.
Mm-hmm.
And without naming him or labeling him, he is allowed to just be.
Yeah, thank you for that, because I know what I'm going to get a lot is, what exactly, is he autistic? Mm-hmm. Does he have Asperger's? And I started writing this book in 2005, before Asperger's or even the spectrum mm-hmm. was a common parlance in America, at least. It just wasn't, I had never heard of Asperger's. I knew what autism was, but it wasn't, you know, you didn't label every child something back then. And
the only thing was Augustine Burroughs, who had, you know, his brother had Asperger's.
Yes, yes, I mean? Right. That was the very only thing funny.
That got into your
right, brain, exactly. So, you know, and Belle, his mother, at some point, you know, Quinn says, I think there's something wrong. And she says, he's just who he is. He's my body and your body. And this is who he is, our own funny little boy. And that's how I felt about him, that he was just himself. He's a little bit of an oddball, yes. But, you know, I was a little bit like that when I was a kid. And most writers I know were like that, when they were just keenly, keenly observant, like almost obsessively observant. But that's how you become a writer. And I'm grateful that nobody medicated me or labeled me, when I don't know how that may have changed the path of my creative life, you know? So I'm glad you said that.
I remembered counting as a kid, you know, well, mm-hmm. of course, that's how you quantify the world.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
You know, it seems like a pretty normal thing to do.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
But one of the things... Obviously, he was close to my heart because he was recording an old lady, which, mm-hmm. you know, that's what all Radio Gorgeous is about, according to recording old ladies in the making.
Yes, yeah.
If we're lucky, we'll get there.
We're not there yet, but we're taking notes, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it just was very evocative for me, as I was saying before. You know, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and I used to pull all-nighters with her.
Love it.
And talking, you know, about her stories and her life. Which her upbringing was so very different from mine.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about old ladies in your life.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I didn't grow up with old ladies in my life because I have a very short-lived family. Mm. I never knew either of my grandmothers. My mother died in her 50s. So I think part of the reason I have gravitated toward older women is because I never had that as a kid. My first job out of college, I went to this fancy college, and my first job was working in an old folks' home. doing activities with these wonderful old people. And one of the best Thanksgivings I can remember in my whole, it's the only one I didn't spend with my family because I was working a double shift. I was just married. I was 23 years old. And my husband and I went down and spent the day at the old folks' home with our guitars and singing. And that's how we spent Thanksgiving, which I couldn't have imagined a nicer way to do it.
Giving thanks.
Yes. Ona is, you know, you pick bits and pieces. She's not really based on anybody in particular, but I think there are two women, formidable women, that come into play, I think, subconsciously when I was writing Ona. And one is our landlady when I was a kid, our Lithuanian landlady, Veronica Mortis, who was a forbidding, she was a tall, kind of four square, terrifying person. And my sister and I used to draw straws to see who would have to go downstairs, three flights of stairs, into her kitchen, which always smelled like root vegetables and cabbage and stuff cooking.
I can smell it now.
Yeah, I mean, oh, and we were terrified of her.
Tasha.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of cabbage. Oh my gosh, that woman lived on cabbage. And so we'd draw straws to see who had to go down and pay the rent, $7 rent. And we would go in and she'd write out this receipt in her meticulous handwriting and then give us the receipt. And sometimes she would give us a chocolate. We'd put our hand out. She'd say, hand. And then she'd put a chocolate. We'd just say, thank you, and then run for it. And the other one is my friend Mary Berry. Isn't that a fabulous name? And her maiden name was Mary Duda. Mary Duda Berry. And she was the opposite. She was this tiny little bird of a woman. And I met her. She was 87 when I met her. For the first time, and I rented a room in her house because I was doing a visiting writer gig at Colby College in Maine, where I live, and it's about an hour and a half from Portland, and so I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go in both feet. I'm going to be on the campus and da-da-da, work on the literary magazine, and so I decided to stay there three or four nights a week and come home on the weekends. So I found this little room in this woman's house, and we became dear friends. Mm-hmm. We were dear friends until the day she died at 98. She was still driving, by the way. And I remember I'd say, Mary, I'm telling you, I'm taking notes on how to, you know, but what I was really doing, I guess, is taking notes on a new book that I didn't even know was coming. But the thing, you know, a lot of this book, too, is about, I feel like thematically, it's about the saving graces of friendship. And also how you just never know. We think we already know the most important people in our lives. I didn't meet her until she was 87, and I was the person holding her hand when she died. You know? I mean, she didn't even know me, and we ended up being really good friends. And she had her daughter, you know, wonderful daughter, but she couldn't get there in time. She lived several states away. And so there I am, this friend of hers she's only had for 10 years, and that's the person you know. And I'm thinking, I'm sure I haven't even yet met, I'm 62, and I don't think I've met yet the person who's going to be the person when I'm 100, if I am lucky enough to get there. That's a beautiful thing,
yeah.
That unfolding surprise of older age.
And it's something that we don't even see. I mean, women in particular, you become invisible in mm-hmm. old age. And like everything, so old ladies look the same.
Yes.
And I just know, as soon as I became a mom, and you know, you just become that person behind mm-hmm. the buggy or the pushchair or the stroller.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're just, it doesn't matter what you did before. And I was like, you know what? No, mm-hmm. I do not, from that moment, yeah. I was like, you do not judge, you don't know who this person was mm-hmm. before they became this role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with old people. My mother and I used to talk about this because they lived in an assisted living mm-hmm. facility. We're talking about, you know, there's this presumption of colorlessness
yes.
in old people.
Mm-hmm.
And in actual fact, she and I found people get, you know, all they have left is their personality. Mm-hmm. And boy, are they sticking to it.
Yes.
You know, with every yep. fierce fiber, mm-hmm. you know, the cramped arthritic hand holding
right.
on for dear life.
You're not kidding.
And my father, I would have to say that is absolutely true of him.
Yep. I think also, too, and Ona says this at one point, is she's just kind of sick of having to be grateful.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. that she's never considered grateful enough for things that people are doing for her. And at one point, Quinn walks into her house and takes a brownie without asking. And her observation is that it had been years since somebody paid her the compliment of presumption.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it's that kind of, I hear what you're saying there.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was Ona Victus has she has three sons, mm-hmm. one of whom was, I suppose one could say, given away for adoption.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, forcibly, yeah. when she was quite young. And she first re-meets him mm-hmm. At a moment, literally, at the precise, the meeting of him is also a moment of finding out the death of a dear friend. Mm-hmm. And the betrayal mm-hmm. by that friend, mm-hmm. judgment and betrayal, mm-hmm. as well as the assassination of President Kennedy.
Right.
And for her, just symbolized by Jackie in mm-hmm. a pink dress
right.
soaked in red blood. And I think that mirrored an experience in your life
mm-hmm.
as well, in your family's life. Mm-hmm. Is that something you would want to share?
Sure. That's the subject of my memoir, which is called When We Were the Kennedys. I grew up in a little mill town in Maine called Mexico, Maine, mm-hmm. Which couldn't have been farther from the Kennedys and all of that. My mother worshipped Jackie Kennedy, like many mothers of the 50s and 60s. They wanted to be like Jackie. She was so glamorous and beautiful and well-spoken and all of that. And we lost my father very suddenly in 1963, in April. He was a worker at the local paper mill, and he literally dropped dead on his way to work, leaving my mother with three little kids, one of whom was mentally handicapped, my sister Betty, and also two grown children in their 20s. So we have kind of a two-generation family. And then a few months later, boom, the president dies. And my mother, after my father died, had a lot of shame about widowhood. She didn't go out very much. She didn't anyway. She was a very shy person. But being without a husband was... And I later found out that this was not unusual at all for women of her generation in particular to feel just ashamed of being widowed. And I think I...
It was poor planning.
Very bad planning on her part. And I think I felt ashamed to be fatherless as well, because we were the only kids in the school without a father. This is in the day when nobody was divorced. I mean, it was such
And you are, especially in a Catholic family,
yes.
you know, a traditional Catholic family at that time, you are yeah. defined by your father.
Yeah, absolutely. What does your father do? It really very much
so. Who
are you from? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was hard. And then when the president was assassinated, I could see my mother's dignity being restored to her by watching Jackie. Well, you remember, of course, the TV was on for 3 days straight, and everybody watching the funeral and the everything. And my mother was kind of narrating it to us, saying, "Now, girls, you see what she's doing? She's got the veil over. She doesn't want people to see that her eyes are all swollen because she's been crying." And she was talking about her own experience of widowhood. And to her, I could see that transformation in her, and I felt the same way. I've always felt an affinity with Caroline Kennedy mm-hmm. because she too lost her dad when she was very young, very suddenly. And I've often wondered about all the other children and women of that year who had the same loss as the Kennedys, and how if they too, you know, felt, you know, related to them in a funny way. Mm. So the title of the memoir is When We Were the Kennedys, and it refers to that, but it also refers to a time in America where we all were prosperous and, you know, yes, we lived in this little town and we worked in a factory, but you could make a good... My father supported a family on his factory wage. Yes, a big family, and you could do that then. So mm-hmm. part of it is just about the loss of American supremacy in manufacturing and the beginning of the end of the middle class in the United States.
Well, and the idea of ourselves is pure and untainted.
Yes,
and,
right.
Yeah,
yeah, that loss of innocence in mm-hmm. so many ways. And in that same year, there was a huge and bitter mill strike. Mm-hmm. So it touches on three things. There's the loss of the father, so that's the, you know, the personal family story. There's the national story, which is the loss of the, quote, father. And then there's also the loss of this very paternalistic factory that ruled everything in the town. So it's thematically, it's really about fathers and children.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
You know, we touched upon earlier, why did the book take so long?
Oh, okay, here we go. This, I think, is a great story for anybody who's discouraged in their career, because I wrote this book right after my 1/2-3rd novel, Any Bitter Thing, which actually did quite well in the States. And I had two publishers at the time, a hardcover and a softcover, which is sort of it was a throwback arrangement. It doesn't really happen anymore. But so my hardcover people, they stopped publishing fiction right about the time I was ready to deliver this novel, which took me 4 years to write. It was 2008, which was right when the big economy collapse of the United States happened. It was the worst possible time to deliver a novel to my agent.
Or anything.
Or anything, exactly. Nobody was buying anything of any kind. And so the paperback publisher was a big commercial publisher, and my agent said, you know, and they had been wooing me. They'd been sending me birthday cards for 2 years, thinking, we really want to acquire you as a hardcover author, da 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 da. So I thought, this is going to be easy, you know, write the book, send it, and I'll have a different publisher, it'll be fine. And they rejected the book. And at that time, there was this pretty good movie, not great movie. I think it was called Up in the Air or In the Air. It had George Clooney in it. And he played this guy who goes around the country firing people at these big corporations. And I went to see the movie by myself. And they intercut these close-ups of these people with pain on their faces who'd been fired in that way. And so I watched the movie, and I get home, and I start bawling my eyes out. And I'm like, why is this stupid movie affecting me like this? And I realize, I said, wait a minute, I just got fired from a job I'd had for 15 years. It felt awful. And I thought my career was over, that I was never going to write anything else. My agent advised me to just kind of put the novel aside and write something else. Like, yeah, okay, 2 weeks later, I'm going to have something else. So I said, okay, fine. So I licked my wounds for about a month. And then I started writing the memoir, just because I wanted to write about home, because it comforted me to write about home. And that book was probably my most successful book so far. And then after that, I couldn't bear to go back to the novel. My husband really wanted me. He loved this book from the get-go. He said, I want to have somebody to talk to about this boy. And nobody else has read it. And I said, oh, I know, but I think it just kind of sucks. It's not very good. I just had completely lost faith in this thing. And at that point, I hadn't read it for about 3 years. So, and then I wrote a play called Paper Maker, based on an earlier book of mine that takes place in a Maine mill town that's on strike. And that got a debut wonderful production at Portland Stage, which is a, you know, an American regional theater that has a great rep, and it was their best-selling play in the history of their so what I'm saying is, this big failure that made me think my writing life was over gave life to these two other things that were two of the most joyful things I've ever done. I loved writing the memoir and I loved writing the play. And before the play came out, Dan said, okay, we made a deal. You said that in, you know, so many, I forget ever making this deal. He probably made it up. I don't know. And I said, well, you know what? I feel like that book is poison right now. I can't even read it. He said, I'll read it to you. I'm married to a total sweetheart. And several nights running, he read that book, the manuscript, to me. And I'm lying there thinking, you know, there isn't a damn thing wrong with this book. What was I so... And it really made me kind of sad that one rejection by this, you know, big fancy-dancy, why was it so easy for me to lose faith in my talent and my... It was really upsetting to me on a metaphysical, existential level. Like, how
was I undone by this?
At my age, with... Everything I have
this
behind,
shit again.
I did. It was awful. And then I said, okay, you know what? I spent another 6 months just kind of reacquainting myself, falling in love with my characters again, made not huge changes, but it's a better version of the one that would have come out. So that's a good thing. And then I sent it to my agent who sold it in 3 days. You know?
Again.
And then it's like going to be all over freaking Europe. I just, oh my gosh. So whoever's listening to this, don't just allow yourself that second chance. I never thought this was going to see the light of day.
Now we're coming back to
yes,
the second chance.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Dug out mm-hmm. of honesty.
Yeah. I know.
I like it.
I know. Isn't it crazy? Oh. It is crazy.
To everyone's second chance.
Yeah. Okay, I'll drink to that. Here's my coffee.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Exactly. Cheers to second chances.
Yes.
And digging deep to get them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.